All right, guys, if you are thinking about buying or selling land, period, you need to do yourself a favor and go check out whitetailproperties.com. The professionalism, the ethic that is just incorporated into the brand and to the land agents themselves, those who you would be working with in your respective region, is second to none. Adam and I have had the pleasure of working with a lot of different folks and a lot of different transactions across lots of different states, but one thing definitely rings true is the caliber in which Whitetail Properties works at. So you owe it to yourself to go check out them online at whitetailproperties.com. Browse their properties. Or if you are interested in seeing what your property may bring, go contact a land agent in your region. They are rapidly growing and spreading across the country. About 40 different states now, they have land agents and representatives in your region. So make sure you check them out, whitetailproperties.com.
This is the Land and Legacy Podcast, brought to you by Whitetail Properties Real Estate. We're your hosts, Adam Keith
and Matt Dye. This is your weekly resource for habitat management, wildlife management, and recreational real estate. We hope you guys enjoy the show. All right, guys, welcome back to another Land and Legacy podcast. We have got a new one for this week because it's a story of a 7.5-year-old buck that just gets harvested by Seth Harker. And we have this full hunt in detail from day one to day four, outlining everything. So we're excited to bring you the new content, and especially one that's revolving around hunting, not just habitat, and how honestly these things just play together. So we're pumped about that. And so you're going to want to definitely tune into to this week's podcast and pick up a lot of really solid information that honestly these tips and these high points from the hunt could really help you be successful on your own pursuit of whitetail on your own property. And really, it doesn't matter your region. These are just the I'm going to say basic, but things you have to get nailed down. So we're going to cover that this week on the podcast, review the hunt. But before we do that, I want to give a quick shout out to Vortex, because Vortex honestly helped make this hunt possible. Early season is always generally revolving around larger food plots, right? Summer patterns, bucks, and we are having to glass a lot, kind of keep our head on a swivel during this hunt. And so Vortex binos were absolutely involved in this hunt. And so if you haven't yet checked them out or utilized their amazing warranty that goes along with all their products, you need to check out Vortex Optics. And you can do that by going to vortexoptics.com or go to eurooptic.com. That's EuroOptic.com. And enter the code LAND 10, all caps on land 10, to get 10% off your Vortex order. Really clear glass, great product, helped us out on this hunt, and a fantastic warranty. So guys, go check them out. And without further ado, let's just jump right into the action and chat about this awesome hunt for Dove Creek 10 and get Seth Harker here on the line. Alrighty, Seth, are you there?
I'm here, man.
Man, what is up? What you doing, Deer Slayer?
I'm actually checking some trail cameras.
Nice. Nice. Don't you love it when they just get sent to your phone?
Oh, man, I love it. It takes a lot of the effort out, and you can run so many more cameras.
It's pretty phenomenal. But man, I just want to get right into the hunt, because I kind of preface this one that we've got some great tips to be able to share and chat about. And so I just kind of want to, you know, introduce this part of the season. Obviously, early season, started hunting I guess it was the second day of the season, our first time out. Before we like dive into the hunt details and the encounters that led up to the harvest, talk to me a little bit about Dove Creek 10. Give some history on this deer, because just as cool as the deer is, the uniqueness of his, him being just a beautiful frame 10-pointer and what have you. Like, the story is just as important and just as cool to be able to, let's say, you know, kind of honor the animal some, because this Doker went through some stuff.
Yes. Yeah, he did. So I guess our first encounter with him was in 2019. And that would have been on the creek that runs through the property, Dove Creek. Mm-hmm. And we were actually hunting another deer, and Trace and I, and this particular spot, you can see just a huge, there's like a horseshoe in the creek. Almost like some of those big river bottoms that they would hunt in Montana, where the creeks.
Sure. Yep.
One can just see forever, and that spot's kind of like that, probably on a smaller scale. But I looked up and I saw that deer, and I was like, man, what a beautiful framed deer. And man, he's bulked up, and man, he's not three, he's possibly four.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really where the story started with him. And I mean, he was had a beautiful rack there, just a beautiful muscled up body, big brisket even at that time, just huge whitetail for our part of the country.
So, and so what age do you think he was then, that big first encounter that you remember?
I think he was four.
Okay.
We have him at four, and I mean, I think we're typically pretty close. I mean, we talk about it a lot, you and I both.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes they can be tricky at four and five.
Sure.
But we're pretty certain this deer was four.
Okay. So 4 years old. The 2019 great encounter with them, weren't able to harvest them. Trace would have harvested them, right, if given the opportunity, I'm sure, at that point, being mature.
Right.
And mm-hmm. he had a pretty sporty set of antlers at four and a half, too, didn't he?
He did. Maybe possibly as big as that, because I guess we'll go ahead and fast forward. Maybe as big as that because of his wound in 20.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But you know, he had a good set in 20, but then he got wounded sometime in October, November. I forget the date stamp. And we did not think the deer was going to, I thought this will be the last time that I see this deer.
Right. I mean, it was a wound of that magnitude. And you sent it to me here recently right after you harvested this deer, just to recall the severity of the wound. And I believe it was like the 8th or the 9th of November. So somewhere in the preceding days there, basically you suspect he had gotten shot at that point or hit by a car, correct?
Yeah. From the picture, I was like, oh, he's been, I'm not sure what, cause obviously you couldn't touch and see and inspect, mm-hmm. you know, after you and I caped, cleaned, so on and so forth. And then we go back to that picture. It was pretty evident what happened, it was an arrow. I'm just certain of it. I mean, even when you go back to that picture, you can see where it grazed in,
mm-hmm.
went behind the hide. It fractured those 3 to 4 ribs, we could tell, and then came back out. And what it looked like was just a steep quartering away shot that the archer had taken. And then I believe the wound channel that we noticed on the hide, which you pointed out, I mean, you could almost see the wound channel there. I just am certain it was an arrow. I mean, whatever it was a long, slender object.
Yeah.
I guess it could have been another rack of a deer maybe at the time, but the wound channel and the hide channel, it definitely looked like a broadhead wound to me.
Right. I totally agree. And I mean, we're talking about a scar, and if you will, not to be gross, but a wound of probably 10 to 12 inches long, easy, on the broad side of the deer, middle of the body, and portions, you know, filleted open, a wound of 4 or 5 inches wide. And so, and it was something significant, very, very visible in the photos that you got. And of course, your mind is, you know, one, you don't know how deep that wound is, but my immediate reaction is, okay, here comes infection. It's not like it's super late into season. Like, we still get kind of warm happening in November, and their body temperature being so warm, like, it can get bacteria in there, it can get infected, and that deer can die from, you know, secondary causes later on from a wound like that. I mean, it was big.
Definitely. And, you know, when we cleaned them, there was like four ribs. There were four ribs that were actually severed. Mm-hmm. I could run my fingers through them, and I was like, ooh, right there. And, I mean, that matched the exact hide when you looked on. I would have never have thought to really look on the back of the hide until you pointed that out. But, mm-hmm. I mean, there it was.
Yeah. Yeah, you could still see that essentially scar tissue from the healing and then, like, the calcification on the ribs. You could feel that. You could feel it externally even before we gutted it, but then, you know, going back and seeing that after this the hide came off, it's like, yep, okay, obviously same deer and significant wound at that point, but he doesn't die.
Like, no.
Right? Like, he's here and somehow.
I'd be back. Yep. He was the Terminator for mm-hmm. sure. 20. So you fast forward, he had the smallest rack after the wound. I don't know if that's significant to point out, or not, but I mean, he was a 9 point. I mean, his name was Dove Creek 10, but last year, 21, he dropped to a 9 point. Mm-hmm. And I suppose, I mean, I guess it could be a ton of other factors, but in my mind, it was just his body overcoming the rut with the wound and so on and so forth, and,
yeah, absolutely.
And he didn't put back into the rack.
Yep, yep. So last year, you guys saw him, you had encounters, correct, throughout the season?
We got close to harvesting him last year, my son did, and it just never would work out. We've saw the deer every year.
Right.
I had encounters with him. Never could close the deal with him. And I will say I really didn't hunt him until – I personally didn't hunt him until this year.
Right, right.
You know, Trace had saw him and not to blow the cover story, but Trace kind of got another one that he was after – and so he lost sight. The carrot was a lot bigger dangling.
Right.
Here we go. Set. Dad gets to hunt the old joker and lesser, not taking away from the rack. I mean, you know me, I like to kill old specimens. Mm-hmm. I don't mind to kill an old specimen as, you know, with a lesser rack. I mean,
that's just the uniqueness of this deer. I mean, super mature. Like every time you'd send pictures of the deer, or every single time we saw him, it was like, without a doubt, there he is. He had a body that was just unmatched. Like, there was not a matured buck on the place that was matching his body dimensions, characteristics of the maturity that this deer had. And I think there's just so few deer like that in the population that when you're able to be in proximity, be able to see, be able to monitor, be able to hunt and have those encounters and then harvest that deer, that is super, super special. So, right, regardless of inches of antler, the deer was a trophy, period, bar none. And he's like, he's a fantastic deer and a beautiful, super symmetrical 10 pointer. So until this year, he hadn't been, let's say, a prime target for you, but going into the first part of season, kind of talk about, you know, some camera placements, how you were monitoring and what you were monitoring that summer pattern, because essentially as everyone knows, has been hearing us talk about on the podcast, is we're in a very heavy mast year, right? So this is one of the key takeaways of the hunt and everything we want to make sure people are aware of. We're racing the acorn drop, essentially. So how were you monitoring this deer and what was he doing on a day-to-day basis throughout late summer?
So this could be a whole nother lengthy conversation, but just to short cap it, when you hunt in the wooded areas that we hunt, I mean, there's roughly, counting the three farms and the one you hunt, there's roughly 1,044 acres, and what is it, like 80% of it is wooded?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'd say so.
I mean, and then around you have big blocks. So it is very hard. This isn't Iowa. This isn't Kansas where you can just look and say, oh, there's the bedding area.
Or that's the funnel. That's the pinch you're going to kill them in.
Right. It is a totally different ball game. And in short, it has taken years to figure out where these deer bed because the whole thing looks like a bedding area. And I would have to say, and you probably hear it every time that I've been on a podcast, it was monitoring and gathering history to where these bedding areas are. Not only that, gathering history of where the white oaks are, which trees fall first. I mean, my cameras were already placed on trees that I knew in the past had fell early and actually harvested a few deer on. So we've got those cell cameras running on those. I want to know when the acorns are dropping.
You preemptively put those out knowing there was a mass crop and knowing that when they start dropping and you start seeing increased activity, that means that a shift is happening, a food source shift, and deer are responding to that limited resource. So those were set and in place, but you also still didn't just give up on having cameras on food plots that always consistently, year after year, and 365 are offering forage, like whether it's, you know, a grain crop or you've overseeded with, you know, fall annuals that are leading through the winter into the spring. This
alfalfa's, clover,
right? You name it, it's up there on this larger. I'm just calling it like a feeding complex because it's not even a food plot. It's just a big old, what is it, 25, 30 acres up there of mixed food and that's just like that's consistent, that's always there. So you were monitoring those areas as well.
Definitely monitoring those. So speaking of which, the last week, the last 3 to 4 days, the acorn trees have flat, and but my timber cameras have they're just blowing up. So we were racing with time, and I mean, they are, the food plots are getting less and less, but back to Dove Creek, there were a couple of spots that he exited, and I've known bigger mature deer to use the fields, and how they enter and exit. So we have cameras placed on those entering exit spots. Mm-hmm. We kind of knew the bedding areas that he was going to, and to and from, and as he got older, watched him, monitor him, trace his, hunted him. So I played cat and mouse with him for, you know, the last 3 years. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, and I think we've talked about it before, but he probably, at his age, probably had the most small home range that I have ever seen him have.
Right. Right.
Now, we can attribute that and say, well, that's his age. We can attribute that and say, well, that's the drought, and you had alfalfa, and you had brassica, and you had clover, like we just talked about, and you were the only good food around, and he was used to that alfalfa during the drought, and then we got the rains, and then you have everything else up there. And, I mean, we can attribute that to a lot of things, but he had a small home range for an old, old deer.
You knew his core area, had it pegged, and had the exits leading to and from food covered with cameras. So when he was using it, you were knowing about it.
Yeah. I mean, out of the four hunts, the only night that we didn't see, well, actually, we could have saw him, he would have turned around.
We just had our back to him at the time he stepped out, And he went and slid into another field. But he came out to the opening where we could have seen him, but we were just swallowed up in other deer in front of us.
Right. And I mean, and it stands, and that's another good point. My rule of thumb, and this may not be everybody's rule of thumb, but it has worked probably 80% for me in early season and late season. If you get a picture in daylight of a deer going to his bed and you have the wind to hunt there, you better be hunting, because almost a guarantee, they're going to come out in that food plot in legal. I don't know what it is. I've lived by that rule. I've got another buddy that lives by it. And if they go in bed in daylight in a, from a food plot in early or late, chances are they're coming out in shooting light. And I mean, that deer was just a prime example. I mean, you and I got in the stand. Here comes the picture. I'm like, son of a gun. He went into bed over there at 6:45 a.m. Well, that's where he came out.
And right, that's not where we obviously were set up. We were off of that because we were trying to pick up what he did night one. And essentially, let's lead right into that. So we kind of laid the groundwork. Hey, we're chasing acorns. We're racing them, hopefully trying to get this deer killed before they really start dropping. But you've preemptively placed cameras there, so we know if there's a shift, we're on it. But right now, night one, we knew, hey, this deer is a frequent customer at these areas. And going into night one, you said, I think we were in the tree. We were in the tree when you had a picture come through email, and he was on the same, let's say, ridge complex, but on his feet at noon, kind of favoring a more eastern side of that, which then would suggest that he was going to come out where we kind of anticipated in the food plot we were hunting.
And that's what he did.
Right. And bright and early. I mean, it was 6:30. I just threw some binos up and just saw this massive brisket with short, stubby legs and a frame and said, I probably stuttered. Seth, big deer. Look. As I'm trying to get the camera.
When you can tell what they are without antlers, that's when you know they're mature. I mean, you don't. And why we were hunting there, where we were, because the camera, this is an interesting kind of angle with it. We were hunting it due to shade line.
Yes. Explain that for a few people, because that's one thing early season that, man, you can't overlook this. It's a huge opportunity for a lot of people to be able to capitalize on and consider when they're placing cameras out, but also how they're hunting it.
Yeah, and especially if the food plot is bigger. I mean, obviously you don't have to worry about that in a one that's just tucked in the woods, because it's shaded all around. But this is a bigger destination food plot, and it has a couple of pine breaks through it that kind of breaks the field up, which are very handy for a lot of different reasons. But this particular, we've been hot, we've been dry. I mean, we sweated every night we hunted, and the camera early, they would come out and they would gravitate towards that shade line that pine break was providing. And I mean, it was dialing them in.
Yeah.
And it was evident what they were doing. They would run.
Oh yeah.
Build and run to it.
It was a magnet, essentially. And that's not an exaggeration. They would run across a pretty wide open field and go to a 16th of the acreage that was planted and go and stand in the shade line and begin feeding. And then from there, they would just begin to filter. They just follow it straight out. But I mean, it was like clockwork. Every single deer was like, well, that's 10 degrees cooler and I'm hungry. I'm going.
It was quite an awesome, and I'm not going to sit here and act like I'm some master deer hunter. I found that by accident, put the camera there. And I mean, the camera would just, I would get pictures and I was like, all these deer, they're in the shade line and they're here. Then it just started clicking. Well, duh.
Yeah.
Where would you, when you're at a picnic, where do you go?
Yeah, for sure. It's down on the river by the shade.
Yeah. So, I mean, it made sense. And you know, that's one reason we were there and saddled right there as well. Because we had the redneck over the other way.
Yeah. Basically the first two nights we hunted, we had a good southeast wind, solid wind, that allowed us to be able to get in there to that set and blow your wind back in a safe direction. Not where the large majority of deer were coming from. And so did that for two nights. The first night had the encounter with with Dove Creek came out at like 6:30, along with, I don't even know how many does it was, 25. Well, I shouldn't say that because it was not all does. There was a lot of young bucks too. But I mean, that we probably end up seeing 30 deer that night, him being one of them. And then another mature deer that kind of like we had our eyes focused on Dove Creek and, you know, kind of saw this other deer, but didn't pay him too much attention because it wasn't a super big target. And the target's at 75 yards and we've got 45 minutes of daylight left. I was like, man, this is going to happen maybe night one. You just never close the distance. And then you look over and there's another mature deer in the field and you're like, oh my gosh, which deer is that? And you're able to identify him. So first night, we've got two mature bucks and a lot of deer in the field, made a game plan essentially for the next night. Hey, there's the exact same wind. Why would we do anything different?
Exactly. Yeah.
But that was the night that earlier that day, I saw you had gotten a picture and he went in at a different location in the field and we kind of hem-hawed back and forth. And it was like, well, every deer we saw ended up in front of us. And even if he comes out over there at that spot that we can't, you know, that's not within bow range, right? Isn't he just going to come down to this portion of the field and feed just like we saw all the other deer? Well, I guess we took a gamble and didn't even have a great wind necessarily set up over where we thought he could come back out, where he'd gone in that morning.
Yeah, regardless. That's what put us there was the wind. I mean, we were playing today.
Yep, for sure. For sure. But yes, that second night is when he came out and we're like, we didn't know it because we were kind of looking the other way and then you got the pictures. But so he did that the second night, but we also saw a third mature deer that we didn't see night one. And that's Mr. Sticky. That's a big frame deer.
Yeah. He's a big one.
Real nice deer. And so again, still really good night, 25, 30 deer in the field, lots of movement during daylight, and thinking, wow, this is just fantastic. But night three, you took your son, Trace, and there was a wind shift. Now instead of the southeast, we've got a southwest wind, and temperatures are rising, and we're getting closer and closer to that acorn drop. What'd you guys see night three?
So night three, well, here comes Mr. Sticky, which Trace, he's seen trail camera pictures of him, kind of the deer that he's wanted to shoot. And here comes Mr. Sticky, and he did the same thing. But if we would have been over to where you and I had been, Sticky would probably...
walked under the platform.
He would be at the taxidermist more than likely, or Trace would have had a shot at it.
Mm-hmm.
So he read the script, came out right in the shape. You know, they followed the scrape line, so on and so forth. And here he's closing the distance across the alfalfa field. And about that time, up out of Voodoo, which that's just this block of timber that we hunt. And
it's cursed.
It is cursed.
But regardless.
If you're down there turkey hunting, deer hunting, it doesn't matter. There's no point in even walking down in Voodoo at this point.
You're not coming back with a filled tag, just period. Don't waste your time.
Yeah, right. And up out of Voodoo, Dickie's closing the distance. Here comes Dove Creek out of Voodoo.
Night three, two mature bucks walking into range.
This is the third night I want to emphasize, this is the third night we've put pressure on this food plot.
Yeah.
So here comes Mr. Sticky, and Trace sees him, and who's Dove Creek? I mean, who cares? He's 13. Oh, it's all about the rack.
That's right. That's right.
Well, that one's not, you know, he doesn't have a pot belly and a swaying brisket. What's a pot belly and a swaying brisket? Look at the rack.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I see that frame. I got two eyes, Dad. Don't try and fool me.
Yeah. Kickers off his both twos, a little bitty kicker, miniature drop tine. I mean, I see that deer. That's the one. well. Dove Creek to him is irrelevant at this time.
Right.
So, and he thinks he's going to get the shot. Almost did. Similar scenario to what you and I experienced on night one when a couple, two or three smaller bucks come in to kind of ruin the show and just didn't spook anything, but they kind of just shifted stuff when they ran. Same thing happened this night.
Those high energy deer that just, the more mature deer, they don't really engage in any of the activity and distance themselves from that, right? So when they're in their bubble, it's kind of like, get me out of here. And so it sounds like they're working in the range, but then kind of got shifted and bumped over from other deer activity in the field.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, Dove Creek, you know, we forgot to talk about night one, how comfortable he was. I mean,
oh man,
he bed out and just bed down.
Yeah. Like, the reason why he was 75 yards and never offered a shot opportunity night one is because there was a limb in the way, and then he just decided to bed down in the field in the fall blend of brassicas, turnips, and kale, and radishes, and all that. He just bedded down in it. A mature deer, 7.5-year-old, right in the middle of the field.
Yep, and it's a thought about spot, because it's a saddle in the field. Johnny saddle, what we call it, because we killed a big deer called Johnny Cash there, so that's where the saddle got its name, and the deer just gravitate towards there, but we hunt it really smart, and that's why we get to make multiple sets there.
Mm-hmm.
We play the wind. I mean, we never go in with a bad wind, and we set late. If you're planning on getting home for supper when you're hunting a spot like that, I mean, you have got to stay late. Those deer need to get there. If the mature deer are in the field, the best thing you can do, in my opinion, is let them get a full belly before you bump them off with coyote, with dog. Sometimes our pine lines and the elevation of the field, sometimes we can slip out, but 99% of the time, we're going to make those deer exit the field by howling or barking them off. And that's, you can hunt it 3-4 times in a row and see those deer. They have not associated and figured out that we're hunting them.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a whole different disturbance. And I think a lot of people, you know, they're not attributing clearing the field to human activity. And so that doesn't put them on edge to come back and return to that. Although, yes, a coyote would be a predator. They encounter coyote howling every night. They encounter coyotes scent all the time. It's just a product of their environment. And so, yeah, it's not a humongous deal to be able to clear the field. And then once it's out of there and it's completely dark, then you get home and you eat your cold supper because you missed supper.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's effective for us. And I mean, when I was young, you know, I would crawl down and there would be deer in the field and I would wonder, why am I seeing less deer every time I hunt here? Mm-hmm. Why are the deer looking up
right
here at set?
Yep.
If the deer are looking up at your set and it's one of your multiple stands you hunt multiple times,
you've been figured out.
Dude, they figured things out.
Yep. Yep.
Deer don't. Very rarely do deer figure my sets out.
Yep.
And I think it's just because, A, we pick sets with cover, B, we play the wind, and C, I mean, we're always going to clear the fields. Always clear the fields. Get those deer down in there for whatever reason. They don't want to mess with coyotes. You howl. You watch with your binoculars. You make sure. Sometimes they can be difficult to get out of the field,
yes,
too.
They can. They'll run to the edge and stop and look, and the only thing you're seeing is a tail that's raised in the air, and it's white. But
yep,
you have to clear the field. Keep howling. Get more aggressive. Get louder. Whatever you need to do to bump them off. But don't let your human presence be the factor that clears the field. Let it be,
yep,
something else.
That's right. And what I've cleared fields for years now, and the closer deer are actually harder to clear than the farther deer. If you just blast loud with close deer, they should be able to see the coyote. They should, I mean, they're like, where is it at? I mean, I should, this thing's ready to nibble my hooves off. Where is he at?
Right.
So if the deer are closer, it is really better to start low, or I've even growled. A growl works. If you can growl, a growl works great, a low growl, and then work higher up if they're deer farther out. But that's just what's worked for me. That's not going to work for everybody.
Right. So we've got three sets in, and night four. Night four is one that, honestly, most times I would have said we would have sat out because it was 94 or 5 degrees. It was warm. The previous days had been in the low to mid 80s, so we're substantially warmer. Still have that southwest wind, but I think the thought of not going after and trying it, knowing again that now we're four hunts into the opener of season, and I know what's in these trees all around this field, and it's going to get very difficult to try and pattern and kill a mature deer once that happens. So you and I talked about it, and I was like, man, I'm gonna leave it up to you, but I'm down to go if you want to go. And, give this thing another whirl, because we've got the time bomb on the acorn crop is ticking, and we're running out of time.
And you forgot to mention, out of all the nasty things you mentioned, all those flies. I've never seen flies.
Oh, my gosh. That was the most bizarre thing. I don't – just like gnats, almost like no-see-ums later in that evening was – unbelievably, almost unbearable. It was bad.
It was awful, man. But so fourth night, and here we are, and I'll be straight with you. I almost what did I tell you? My limit typically is three times. You hunt a spot three times, and then you let it rest.
Right.
And a lot of times, my thought process behind three times, typically if you have a, and that's one of my strategies, typically if you have a good deer that is frequenting a food plot, and you can get three sets in, and he's a normal customer, and if you hunt it smart, typically one out of those three nights, it's worked for me well in the past. One out of those three nights, you're going to see them or get a shot out of them.
Right.
Again, that falls back to hunting really smart. But you'll notice probably in your own trail camera pictures that a lot of times, one out of three nights, you'll have that joker there in that field. So instead of just, if the wind's right, I mean, I'll hammer it three nights in a row. And it's just been a good strategy that and a lot of times we're killing them on night three,
Yeah.
Which goes against everything that I've read a lot of literature, and that goes against everything that you read.
Well, I think that's due in part by not having good, clean access to fields and knowing where deer are coming from, where they're going, and how you need to change your access pattern. We always make that statement, the phrase, oh, deer lazy. Well, dadgummit, I know hunters are lazy too. And you take the path in there that's just the easiest and not always the best. And you're educating deer every time you do that, hey, this place is not safe, or it's being hunted and I need to be cautious. And so I'm going to start coming here after dark and frequenting after dark. And, I think that's the stuff that literature doesn't really talk about, but you can avoid that, right? You can hunt smart, you can access things, you can clear the field and make sure the winds are cooperating when you're in there. And if they're not, then you get out.
You get out, yeah. And And to emphasize what we've talked about, so I hear all the time, well, if I had manicured place to deer hunt, I could do that too. Well, maybe you could, maybe you couldn't, but we need to emphasize two deer out of the last 2 years, we've dug broadheads out of their shoulders. So
that weren't by your bow.
That were not by us.
Like there's hunting pressure around you. This is not a you know, the most fantastic dreamed up situation. It's one that, hey, there's an age structure because you're targeting older age class deer. And some neighbors are doing the same or trying to do the same. Be diligent with that. But you have the ability to have those in the herd. But regardless of whether they're there or not, this is the thing, this is the rubber that meets the road, is you still have to hunt them wisely and be diligent to be successful.
Yeah, you just have to. And complacency kills. And I mean, that's the best strategy if you own a piece of property, in my opinion, that you can have. If you get a deer comfortable, you can kill them. I mean, they will lay down in your food plots and chill out. And because you have all that habitat, you've got escape structure or habitat. You have everything that they need on that property, and you're not just going in there just blowing it out. They are comfortable, and complacency kills them.
That's it. Yep. So what does the rest of night four look like? Bring us to the moments that he steps out and you seal a deal on him.
So we're seeing a lot of the same bucks.
Yes.
that we had saw the last three nights.
Mm-hmm.
What was really funny, part of the, which I don't know if they did it that night, they were over there scraping, but you and I had trimmed some limbs night two on a locust tree, and we hinge cut the limbs where they would basically fall out of our view, but they wound up landing and right about scraping height, and wouldn't you know it, that's exactly what the deer decided to do. Hey, we'll make a scrape right here.
Right.
So a lot of those same bucks, they're cruising in, they're doing their thing. We've seen these deer. And then here comes Mr. Sticky, of course.
Yep.
And, you know, it's in the back of my mind, man, that deer, for my standards, he needs another year before we hunt him. For my son's standard, he's ready to hunt, and I'm not going to tell my son that he can't shoot him. So if he slips through the cracks and we don't get him, great. But if he doesn't and we get to get him, that's great. I will tell you that would have been really hard, but I was making my mind up that Trace had made his mind up the night before. That's the one he wanted.
Right.
And he basically, threw the deer that I'd already been hunting. I mean, Dove Creek was the story. He was the deer that we wanted to shoot.
Definitely. Definitely.
So, and then Matt is laying down the footage. Dove Creek is 60. I think I'd ranged him. He was 60 yards and Matt was filming a deer. I believe that young deer was making a scrape when you were filming, or he's doing something.
That was the deer that has the velvet hanging on him. And I was like, oh, that's just kind of cool. I want to get a tie to that. He was broadside, you know, 35, 40 yards or so away in the field. And just getting the image of that. And he just kind of walks out of the frame, just kind of a nice, normal shot. And I hadn't ended the clip yet as that deer walked out. And then I looked, just kind of glanced back over, and I wasn't looking at the viewfinder. I looked out the actual blind window, and boom, see antlers come into the field. And then that's when I get real excited.
Yeah, people are going to think it's all fake. They're like, how do you know that deer was coming out there?
I know, right? Seriously, they're going to see the footage and be like, wow, that's a sixth sense right there. I'm going to say, no, that's what you call just right place, right time, where the camera was looking, because that was totally accidental. But yeah, the frame, he comes into frame, walks right in there, And what was kind of interesting that night, I don't know if he felt like he was kind of late to the party or not, but he didn't just come right to the edge, even though at this point it was all shaded. That Joker just, he's like strolls out. He went from field edge to in range pretty quickly.
He did, yeah. And, you know, we'd got pictures of him too, that had came in. He had been on that twin white oak down at Voodoo.
Yep.
And I don't know if that's what hung him up, but yeah, when he gets there, I mean, he's coming to the saddle, the spot they always go to.
Yep.
I mean, to congregate, they just come to that spot, and that's why the stand is there.
That's right. That's right.
So again, how do I know this? History.
Yep. Watching deer get super comfortable, killing deer out of that same set in the saddle, and them just migrating, using that topography feature, even though it's kind of subtle there, using that to their advantage, and getting down in there where it's comfortable. And, man, he did it and got to 40 pretty quick.
He did, 40 yards, and kind of touch and go there for a minute, getting them just where you want them. And man, we finally made it happen and put a good shot on him. He didn't go far at all. I am glad he did not go far. That was a clear cut.
That was a clear cut and downhill.
Yeah, that's always the struggle with shooting them right there is the little saplings throughout there, and it's tough to drag them uphill and everything.
No, absolutely. You made an awesome shot, and I want you to talk about that shot, because it's kind of an experiment for us. It kind of through 10X TV started working with Rec Broadheads. You guys may have seen some of that stuff on social media, and it's REK Broadheads. And this is the first deer that I've seen get shot by one. It's piqued my interest looking at their offering there. But man, talk about, let's say, the wound channel and damage that thing did.
Unbelievable.
And I should preface this. I'm not like super nerdy when it comes to broadheads or I want to put something on the end of my arrow that I'm confident and comfortable with, but like, you know, when it comes to the latest and the greatest and all this stuff, that's not me. I'm like genuinely impressed by what happened with this deer and what the broadhead did.
Oh, definitely. I mean, you're talking blew through chest cavity, hit offside shoulder. And I mean, I've shot a lot of broadheads. Broadheads are kind of like me, that women have fetishes with shoes. I have a fetish with broadheads.
It's a safe place here. You can admit that.
You come in the room, you're going to see all shapes, all sizes. I buy them, have in the past, just to try them. I mean, I'll stick with one when I like it, but I've tried a lot of them out there. Not all of them, but I'll promise you, I'll be having a wreck on my arrow shafts. And I think a lot of it, you know, I've shot a lot of heads, but I think that tip, that, because, you know, that slip cam, which there's slip cam technology out there, and everybody knows slip cam broadheads, they don't deflect the way they slip cam. They go, whether it's quartering, no matter what it is, a slip cam goes where you put it. They blow a big hole. But none of them have a tip like this.
Yeah.
And not only that, the blades are extremely thick. They're extremely robust. And the shoulder, offside shoulder, was like you'd shot it with a rifle. I mean.
Yeah. I mean, this is a 7.5-year-old deer, old deer, big bodied. And you hit, I mean, your entry was perfect, right behind the shoulder, slightly quartering away, and blows through that offside shoulder, low on the body cavity, and so, like, right above the joint. I mean, it blew through and didn't stop. Like, the arrow was found 10, 15 yards past the point of impact, and we get up to that deer, and one, the entry hole was vertical. And it's just the most clean entry that I think I've really seen. I mean, it just, you talk about like a slice, it just went right through that animal. And then that offside shoulder was, I mean, clean, square in the center of that thing, just broke off and dangling. Just like you shot it with a rifle. Like the entry side shoulder with a rifle.
Yeah.
When you square it up and it's just like, oh gosh, just kind of like feel like jello in there. That's what the shoulder felt like.
It was definitely a great head. I'm thoroughly impressed. And I also like, I mean, they're mechanical. So any mechanical head, it has some sort of retainer clip to hold the blades.
Mm-hmm.
And the retainer clip that holds the blades, I like the way that the tip is accessible. You take the tip off, you put the retainer clip in. As you tighten the retainer clip, the grooves of the blades line up and catch the blade.
Right.
Like any mechanical head, when you pull it out of your quiver, before you knock it, you check.
Yep.
You check it out, you check it over. No matter what it is, you check. I mean, it's mechanical.
Yep.
And as long as everything's good, and if it's not, you unscrew the, I mean, you can unscrew the tip and make sure everything's good right there in the field. It's pretty simple to do.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Well, it definitely did the trick. I mean, I think the deer probably ran 80 to 100 downhill, and was stumbling the last 15 to 20 hard.
Oh, yeah.
And, man, it was just an awesome hunt. But there's those takeaways of, you know, chasing acorns, being consistent in how you're hunting, but hunting those consistent winds, being very smart about your entry, and your exiting, how you're exiting, when you're exiting, how you're clearing the field, by means of non-human type intrusion there, but also just being consistent with making sure you're getting that inventory when it comes to trail camera information, and how generally speaking, those, like, and we've said it before, Seth, definitely big believers, trail cameras don't show you everything, but when you do have them placed and in the right locations preemptively, whether it's before acorns start dropping or historical locations that are always hit by deer at certain times of the year, you do get an advantage of knowing what's going to be happening. And they definitely played a role in it, but also just good, clean woodsmanship and delivering a broadhead rocket out of the bow, out of the Matthews, and it worked.
Mm-hmm. Yep, great hunt, too. I was really, thank you for laying it all down on the footage. You know,
oh,
so
man.
I can return the favor. So
I'm happy to do it at any time, because that was just, man, that got me jazzed up. That was a lot of fun, and just to be able to have those encounters, I think it was, you know, three different mature bucks, and every single night we had mature bucks in the field, sharing the evening with them, and it was just cool to see all that deer behavior, sparring by young bucks, some scraping activity, and just also a lot of head down foraging heavy. So
yeah.
Definitely.
Nope. Heard some grunts and
yep for sure. Seth, I certainly appreciate you taking time to share the hunt, and I know you and Trace are going to be back after it and out there as his time allows, but you're all going to have some other good hunts to come this season. I know it, because there's some good deer around, and you're starting to get them figured out here as these acorns are dropping.
They're starting to make the transition, doing what we love to do, and that's figure them out.
That's it. That is the game, and sometimes you got to get into the timber with them, and I wouldn't be surprised if you start having to do that.
Yeah, I love a good timber hunt.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Well, thank you, sir, for your time and sharing all your knowledge with everyone, and I know that they always love hearing from you and following along on the hunt. So, guys, we're anticipating this hunt being on 10X TV next year. So next year, quarter 3 and 4, you'll be able to find this out. So you're not going to want to miss it. I think it came together super well, and it'll be a great hunt to tune into. But Seth, again, thank you. And we'll chat soon. We'll be in a tree stand or a blind here soon again, I know.
All right. Thank you, Matt. Appreciate it.